which I would have done last night, because by the time the tire was fixed, it was 9:30, but I didn't have clothes.
So good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and call to order the Senate Committee on Judiciary. I want to thank everyone for being here. Today we have two bills that we have scheduled, one for public hearing, a possible work session, which is Senate Bill 1554. The second bill is scheduled for public hearing only, Senate Bill 1561. For those who are here on Senate Bill 1554, we'll take the public testimony now. We are waiting for the fiscal. The fiscal is not cleared. We are hoping that possibly magic will occur while we're here today. And if it does, and we get the fiscal before we adjourn, then we can take action on it if the committee is ready to go forward. But with that understanding, we're going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 1554. And Chandler, are you going to take the lead?
Certainly. Chair Przanski, members of the committee, you might remember in 2015 that we had Senate Bill 369, which was the Uniform Fiduciary Access to Digital Assets Act. I'm going to give you a little background on that bill. It came through this committee. We had a really interesting debate on it. There was another bill in a House committee that did some similar but not quite the same things. There were some issues with both bills, and so the Senate bill went down to rules and continued to be worked on. We had a small work group that also worked on further amendments to this bill. On the national level, the Uniform Law Commission met again to continue working on this bill and came up with a revised measure almost as soon as we had adjourned from the 2015 session. So what you have today is the revised Uniform Fiduciary Access to Digital Assets Act. The measure allows companies that hold electronic user data to offer users a choice on what they'd like done with the data should that user become inactive or deceased or otherwise incapacitated. The user choice trumps all other indicators or documents, such as a will or a trust or a terms of service agreement. The measure lays out what a fiduciary must provide to a custodian of records in cases in which a user consents to disclosure or if the court orders disclosure. It also specifies the procedure for a fiduciary to request contents of communication in cases in which a user has not made a choice or has chosen not to disclose. The measure allows the fiduciary to receive a catalog of communications that the user has made, including the to and from, people that sent the email and received it, the email addresses, and the date and time of such communications. We have a proposed -1 amendment that clarifies that if a user has designated a person to receive this, that person isn't necessarily a fiduciary, and that certain provisions of this measure also apply to them. We are still waiting on the fiscal. We'll let you know if we get it.
All right, thank you. So we have, I have three people that have signed up. I'm going to just ask everyone to come up as a panel. Lane, Jeff, and Megan, if the three of you would please come up. While they're coming up, I will state I understand this is as close as we can probably get to as a kumbaya. I understand that they're from the different perspectives. Maybe they might want this or a little bit of that, but everyone has agreed this is a great starting point for the state. So hopefully the testimony will support that statement I just made.
Got to point out it would not be a legislative or a judiciary committee without seeing Lane at least one time.
Thanks, Senator Cruz. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Lane Shetterly, and it is good to see you. Good to be back. Here today in my capacity as a commissioner from Oregon on the Uniform Law Commission, Jana did a very good job of reciting the history of this bill. It was a little bit tortured last session where we had the Uniform Act and then we had the Tech Industries Peace Act. And actually that's really replicated itself around the country where pretty much the acts drew to a draw throughout the country and really nobody moved forward. And so that's always the recipe for a second look. And that's what happened last summer when the Uniform Law Commission reconvened with the representatives of the tech industry, sort of an after-action report and a second effort to come up with a revised act that would pass, and compromise and consensus was achieved. Like all compromise and consensus, I think everybody left a little bit on the table that they wish they had gotten in the bill, but better to have what we have than to have nothing at all. It's a significant step forward in terms of creating a rational scheme for to authorize fiduciary access to digital assets of protected persons. Just briefly, in the big picture, if you'll recall, the fiduciaries that this bill deals with are the same fiduciaries as we were working with in last session. That is, personal representatives of decedents' estates, trustees of trusts, agents under power of attorney, and conservators of an incapacitated person. Those are the individuals who we're dealing with in this bill primarily. And what we've created in it is a tiered system so that if a provider creates an online tool separate from the terms of service agreement, whereby a user can go on and use that online tool to designate who will have access in the event of death or incapacity or other circumstances, that online tool will control who has access under what circumstances. And we hope that the tech industry will move to that kind of an online tool, much as the way banks do with joint or even transfer on death kind of accounts. It's a very easy and clear method of designating a fiduciary to have access. Absent an online tool, or if someone doesn't use the online tool, they can designate who will have access in a will, in a power of attorney, in a trust, or some other written record. So the user has the power to designate a person who will have access. Failing that, the terms of service will control who has access and in the event of death or incapacity. So we at least have these opportunities for specific designation of access. Absent any kind of designation, it is clear in the Act that content of electronic communication will be protected. It will not be disclosed. Short, again, of a designation, appropriate designation or exercise of a written, of a online tool. That is in sync with the Federal Stored Communications Act. However, even without a designation, a fiduciary still will have access to what's called a catalog of communications, as Chana said, which will at least allow the fiduciary to see the sender and may be able to identify assets or other material information through a review of who has been sending on an account. The bill also makes clear that fiduciaries who act under this act are subject to all of the fiduciary duties that apply to fiduciaries under state law. That's duty of loyalty, duty of confidentiality, all those things, due care that apply to fiduciaries generally. And it includes provisions for immunity for providers who release information or provide access digital assets or content of electronic communication in reliance, reasonable reliance on the Act. I'm happy to say that the tech folks who are here in the room are either in support of the bill or are vigorously neutral on it. She's not here today, but Kimberly McCullough from ACLU, you may remember, she was on at the table last session. She's not able to be here today, but she did communicate that ACLU is fine with the bill this session. So we do believe that we bring you a consensus and compromise that, again, like all compromises, doesn't get as much as I want, may give up a little more than Megan would like, I hope. But we do consider that it is a significant step forward that, taken together, will advance the law in this area. So I thank you for your opportunity. I'd be happy to answer a question after my fellow witnesses have spoken, and urge you to pass this bill with support, move this bill forward with a due pass when you get the fiscal. Just final note, we do have letters, I think, in OLIS from Google and Facebook that do affirmatively express support for the bill in its form as negotiated and as presented to you.
Thank you. Who would like to go next?
Guess I will proceed. Chair Pozanski, members of the committee, my name is Jeffrey Sheen. I'm an attorney with the law firm of Samuel Gill and Cantor in Portland, Oregon. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon State Bar in the state planning section in support of SB 1554. And the estate planning section consists of over 1,000 attorneys throughout Oregon who help clients with their estate plans and implementation and administration of those estates. One of the things, and I want to thank Mr. Shetterly for the Greg and Chana for the good explanation of this bill. One of the burdens that's going to be placed on both the attorneys who do estate planning and also on citizens of the state of Oregon is, I think this bill makes it very clear that there's going to have to be an affirmative decision in pretty much in writing, either to elect the opt-in provisions that are provided by the electronic service provider, or else and the directions to authorize a personal representative or attorney in fact or trustee or conservator are going to need to appear in such documents as powers of attorney, wills, and trusts, which so that's going to add a little bit more of a push from the for attorneys to see that as they go through the client interview process to get that into the documentation so that the fiduciaries have an idea of what the client wants to do. And I think this bill is an important step forward because it does clarify that, indeed, account users do have the ability to designate how they want their account content to be treated. They have the right to say it should be deleted. They have the right to say it should be shared with someone, and I think that's a very significant step forward. And the problem that this is correcting that we had is a lot of electronic service providers had their service agreement, which in not all cases but in many cases said that once the person passes away, that account gets closed and the provider has the right to destroy that content. And in dealing with digital legacies, which are becoming more and more prominent, that became pretty problematic. And I submitted some written materials to you, and I won't take too long with those, but this bill today before you is a product of the National Law Commission, Uniform Law Commission, and a lot of work has gone into it outside of this room. And so the section in the bar supports this, and I'm available for any questions or comments. Thank you.
Thanks. We'll take Megan's testimony, then we'll do questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Megan Schrader. I'm with TechNet. TechNet represents over 70 of the nation's leading companies in the fields of internet and social media, information technology, green technology, and venture capital. I'm very happy to be able to provide comments today, and we'll keep them brief. But after a lengthy stakeholder process in the interim, very happy that the Uniform Law Commission was able to come up with a compromise to allay some of the concerns from the technology industry that you may remember from the previous session. Deserved many thanks, and it was a wonderful process. This bill represents a common accord between the technology industry, the Uniform Law Commission, and privacy advocates, and we are happy to support the model bill and the amendments as drafted. The revised version keeps consumer choice as paramount and provides adequate protection for service providers under the disclosure of data, making sure that we can still comply with federal law as well as disclosing the amount of data that needs to be disclosed in order to close a person's estate. So thank you so much for the opportunity to provide a little bit of feedback, but we're happy to support the model bill.
Thanks. Common accord. Is that something by you?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Just making sure yes. We're on the same page.
Yeah. Or a car. Or the two.
Oh, yeah, it could be a court. We got to have a little levity here. So.
I get it.
All right. So it must not have been since you had to explain it. I do want to put on the record, though, what I think I heard was that if the service agreement you go through and the owner of the account states that I want Lane Shetterly to be having access to this to my files, etc. Does that control and is that the priority, even if someone then subsequent to that draws up a will, and in the will it makes a different directive for who is supposed to have access to the electronic accounts?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes, in that respect, it is like designating a pay-on-death beneficiary on a bank account. If you name somebody on that bank account to receive those funds when you pass away, it doesn't matter if you execute a will after that that leaves your entire estate to somebody else. That pay-on-death beneficiary will still receive those funds because they are on that account agreement to receive the funds. So if you an account holder uses an online tool to designate somebody as a fiduciary to have access to the account, that will control unless they change that online tool designation.
And Chair Przonski, if I may add to that, the measure does specify that the online tool has to allow the user to modify or delete the direction at any time in order for that to take
effect.
So if it's a one-time provision, that might not apply. But if it's something that the user could access again to modify, then it would remain.
Okay. I just want to put this on the record for we have established what the protocol actually will be. And so people will know that that's exactly what was intended by this legislation. Any other questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Lane, good to see you.
Good to see you.
In a different committee. So my understanding is that the language in front of us is based on some model language that's also being introduced in some 20 other states. And so is the goal here to have some sort of uniform provisions that would start to get accepted around the country?
Senator Brzezinski, Mr. Chair, Senator Rosenbaum, excellent question. And I'm sorry, you weren't in the debate last session, so I really didn't take everybody through the overview of this. But yes, you know, the Uniform Law Commission is an organization of the states that that writes laws intended to be adopted uniformly or in substantially uniform form by states around the country, and by doing that achieve uniformity in areas where uniformity is practical and of benefit. And here in this case, it is of particular benefit to have a uniform approach to this, just because of the nature of the beast. That this is, these are online providers, and certainly the scope of their services is national and even obviously global. But we're dealing with on a national basis. So yes, the Uniform Law Commission has adopted this, I think there will be about 25 enactments this year. It's anticipated. The hope is that within a period of a couple of years, we'll have this adopted in all the states or substantially all the states. And so in doing that, we'll create a uniform system of regulation for the states without having to rely on Congress to get there. That's a gap that the Uniform Law Commission often fills, to provide uniformity among the states. Absent reliance on federal legislation. So that's what we're doing, yes, indeed, to create a uniform overlay of these laws. And that's why, too, the tech industry's support for the act is on the condition and understanding that it will be uniformly adopted and not substantially amended in all the states, so that you do have the same system in each of the states so that they can rely on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You had any other questions or comments? And then just to let you know, Senator Rosenbaum, Lane is actually our representative to the National Uniform Commission. So he is the one that we sent out to get this information, do the fighting for Oregon, and come back. And so thanks to all three of you for your participation and for all the other groups. I know that the interim work groups are one of those situations that sometimes things kind of just get testy. Sometimes they go real smoothly. I think this one, from all indications, went very well. and very appreciative that we have the opportunity in the interim to have these type of work groups to kind of work through this so we can hopefully put forward the best piece of legislation for the citizens of the state. So any other comments?
Right.
We're trying to buy a little time to see.
Yeah. Did you hear the one about?
Anyway, thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
Now, I had no one else that was scheduled or at least signed up for the to be a witness on 1554. I do not want to prohibit anyone. So does anyone want to come forward to give any other comments or testimony on Senate Bill 1554? Not seeing anybody raising their hand or running up here quickly, we'll go ahead and close the public hearing on 1554. And at this point, we do not have the fiscal back, so we can't move the bill. What my plan will be is to carry this over to tomorrow. We're going to just start carrying over anything that we complete our public hearings on, so we can move those bills as quickly as we get the fiscal and any other paperwork. With that, we are waiting for the senator who is going to do the presentation on the next bill, which is Senate Bill 1561. She is in a subcommittee, and she was going to hopefully get out of there any moment. So I think the thing to do now is just going to recess, and we'll stand by for hopefully no more than 3 or 5 minutes.
Seen her somewhere before.
All right, I'm going to go ahead and call the Senate Judiciary Committee back to order. We're out of recess. We're now at this point where we're going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 1561. And Chana or Whitney?
It'll be me. Thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. This is Senate Bill 1561 and is brought to us today by Senator Steiner Hayward. There is no revenue impact, and we do not have the fiscal impact. This measure pertains to ORS 109.119. This is a statute that governs when a person who is not a parent to a child may petition for custody, guardianship, visitation, contact, or other rights with that child. Senate Bill 1567 adds a provision requiring the court to consider ordering a person who is awarded custody, visitation, or other rights under this statute to contribute to the financial support of the child. In making this decision, the court is to consider the nature and extent of the contact allowed. Finally, Senate Bill 1567 allows any person to petition to modify or set aside financial support or custody, visitation, or other rights ordered without a showing of substantial change of circumstances. There are no amendments.
All right, thank you. And to start off, we're going to have opening statements from Senator Elizabeth Steiner Hayward.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ms. Perez, for the summary. It's just to clarify, it's 1561, I believe,
oh,
not 67.
I just
want to make sure that we're all talking about the same bill. For the record, Elizabeth Steiner Hayward, State Senator, Senate District 17. As all of you have experienced, oftentimes our constituents come to us with concerns about issues that they're facing that may potentially require a change in statute to address not only their situation, but the situation of others in similar circumstances going forward. And such was the case with my constituent, Tara Carlson, from whom you will hear a little bit later, who ended up in a somewhat complex situation with her children and an ex-partner around the concept of psychological parent, which is an important part of Oregon's law. However, the financial situation got complicated, and there was some lack of clarity, or at least there's a concern that there's a lack of clarity in statute about when a psychological parent should be contributing to usual and customary expenses, to child support, to other expenses related to bringing up these children. And so the intent of Senate Bill 1561 is to clarify that in statute to make sure that somebody doesn't, that we don't keep anybody from pursuing psychological parent status if that's appropriate and in the best interest of the child, but we also don't pose an undue financial burden on the parent with legal standing with the child, immediate legal standing with the child, whether biologic or by it through adoption or whatever, where they assume a significant percentage of the burden of financial support without assistance from somebody who has significant visitation or custody rights as a psychological parent. And I will let my constituent, her attorney, and others comment on it in more detail because I am very clearly not an attorney. And others who know much more about the law have been kind enough to come and testify. And I will apologize in advance. I'm going to have to boogie back to my other committee because we're missing quorum down there without me. So happy to take questions now or later.
I think we'll let you go, but before you do, your constituent and then whoever else is coming up with her are not on the list. So if you can just
I'm sorry. I didn't know you guys didn't sign in.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Is it just going to be you, Tara, testifying?
Okay, just two.
You come on up.
Okay, sorry about that, Mr. Chair. I apologize. I didn't sign in.
I just want to make sure we capture everyone that needs to be.
Mr. Chair, before we go too deep in, is psychological parent a legal term?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, it is.
I'd like a kind of an understanding of.
Sure, we can help with that.
Before we go, I think. Senator needs to get back to her.
I do, and I apologize, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much.
Fine. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your hearing this bill. Sorry to boogie you guys.
No. We can boogie on without you.
So before we get started, excuse me, what I'd like for y'all to do is just give us your names so we can have those as part of the record. And then when you give your testimony, you need to self-identify before you give your testimony. And do we want to go ahead and get that question answered before we go? I mean, if it's puzzling you,
I can address that.
Yeah, first let's get names, so we'll put those down, and then we'll have you explain the definition.
Sure.
And then we'll go into the testimony.
Sure. So my name is Burton Francis. It's Burton, last name Francis, and I'm a licensed attorney in Oregon and California.
Thank you.
And I'm Tara Carlson, TaraCarlson.
Thank you. Mr. Francis, why don't you go ahead and give the definition?
Senator Cruz, is it?
Yes.
So we've got this interesting thing called psychological parents in Oregon, and it's called de facto parent in Washington. And it's basically a situation where there's been such a significant relationship that's developed between someone who's not a biological parent and that child, okay? And so there's a provision in Oregon law, the statute that's seeking to be amended here, where someone can petition the court and say that, you know, I would like the rights that are attendant parenthood because I have this significant bond with this person. And it originally arose, I think, under a grandparent sort of situation where grandparents and then the couple would split and separate and what have you, and maybe something happened to the mom or something, and the parents of the mother would come in and say to the father, look, you know, we've got this significant relationship. We'd like to have visitation or something like that. But more commonly now, as society has evolved, it is being more applicable to same-sex couples, where you have one couple who is a biological parent who has, you know, had children through artificial insemination or some other mechanism, and then you have another parent who is basically there as a couple, but they're not a biological parent. So traditional family law has required that if you have two biological parents separate, you know, they have a divorce, and one of those biological parents is better off than the other one, then you're going to equalize the income through support mechanism so that it's for the best benefit of the children, okay, so that, you know, the children don't suffer from the fact that that division has occurred. Oregon hasn't caught up to the fact that you have same-sex couples now who are in very basically the same situation. If you're going to call them a psychological parent, they're going to be in a parent rubric, basically, right? That if that couple decides to have children and then they later separate and divorce, there's no mechanism now by which the obligations of parenthood are going to be imposed on the couple that's not the biological parent, okay? So they can petition for the rights of parenthood under psychological parent, but currently they're not under the obligations that a parent would be under if they were under in a biological situation. So recognizing the public policy, the rectitude of that public policy, you know, that the children shouldn't suffer just because, you know, one parent is better off than the other. And also, you'll hear from Tara, there's the psychological dimension also, you know, the power relationship that occurs where one party has more money and is able to buy things and provide for this and that, and then starts to want to call the tune in terms of, well, it should be according to my schedule because I'm the one paying for this or whatever. Under normal biological parent situations, there's an equalization that goes on there through the support mechanism. So all this amendment is trying to do is to try to equalize that situation.
Okay, I understand that. But I think I really would like to have the constituent, have Tara give her stuff, and then we can go into
more. Okay. Absolutely,
I just
sure.
I want to get this out so people wouldn't be thinking, what is this?
Right.
Okay. So Tara, why don't you give us your statement?
Okay. Good morning, members of the Judiciary Committee. My name is Tara Carlson. I'm the biological mother of two fraternal twin boys who are 6 years old. Over 7 years ago, my partner at the time agreed to let me pursue parenthood. Back then, same-sex couples could not marry, but I'm not sure that would have mattered since my partner refused to register because she was very protective of her new, largely acquired income. We decided that she would be the breadwinner and I would be the stay-at-home mom, an arrangement that worked out over the first 2 years. At this point, differences arose and were too great to be worked out. We went to mediation and almost had an agreement. A month later, she filed a petition with the family court in Multnomah County seeking psychological parent status. Her resources were much greater than mine, and I had a hard time financially keeping up with litigation. Her parents were able to afford very high-priced lawyers, and eventually, after a few evidentiary hearings, my attorney became overwhelmed, and I was advised to settle against my wishes, not this attorney. In the judgment, the family court found that the legal parent presumption had been overcome and my former partner received 40% custody that was carefully labeled with a euphemism, visitation and parenting time. Although my former partner makes about four times my income, her only expense for 40% time is for the food she feeds them while they are with her and for traveling costs when she takes them to England to visit her parents. These expenses of clothing, school uniforms, medical care, medication, child care, savings for college all fall on me regardless of whose care they are in. At the time of settlement, the judge told me through my attorney that she did not have the authority to award any child support through the standard income and support calculation procedures set up in family court, even though it was submitted. Instead, my former partner agreed to make what her lawyer described in the judgment as a voluntary contribution of $500 per month for both children, and I'm reminded of the voluntary nature of this money over and over. One would think that if someone claims to be the parent of a child, whether it is the old-fashioned biological kind or this recently created psychological type, that this parent would both enjoy the benefits of having that child as well as the obligation of providing for that child. This is not the case in Oregon. However, I understand that California and Washington parents in my situation are treated the same as their biological parent counterparts. And so, at least in my situation, this voluntary contribution for my former partner always seems to be hanging by a thread based on whether or not she feels like I'm accommodating all of her needs. For example, I'm always working around her schedule for school breaks. When after school care or summer breaks comes and an extra child care or summer camp arrangements need to be made, this voluntary sum is used as the reason why she isn't obligated to contribute to the health and well-being of the two boys she is claiming to parent. I love my boys more than anything, and I want them to have every opportunity available to them. So it's hard for me to understand why my former partner can claim to be the other parent and yet have no legal responsibility for their financial well-being. For the past 3 years, my family had to rely on public assistance of OHP, SNAP, and ERDC until recently when I found steady employment. As a direct result, my ex was able to benefit from these programs, although her income grossly saturates the poverty line. This was a system I would not have been compelled to use had she been required to support the children financially. I struggle and make ends meet every month. We live in publicly subsidized affordable apartment housing. However, when summer comes, my budget is even more underwater because the boys are out of school and need extra care that I cannot afford. And so I go begging the other parent. I ask her not to take her allotted vacation week during the time of which summer camps or childcare are available so that we can still work. She opts out of being accommodating so as to fill in the gaps, leaving me with highly expensive drop-in care rates. As the law currently stands, my boys' welfare is not being completely met. I worry about their future opportunities because the other parent is not legally obligated to contribute to their financial well-being, unlike legally obligated biological parents. Although I am their biological parent and I have physical custody of them 60% of the time, I am constantly begging my former partner to step up for the boys. It's a humiliating position to be in, but I do it in an effort to see that my boys' needs are met. I'm asking for this legislation to amend the current statute, ORS 109.119, so that all parents, whether they are the biological or psychological, are treated equally under the law. Even though my former partner enjoys all the benefits of 40% custody, she's under none of the obligations that other parents are under to provide for their children. I'm just asking with the same respect and dignity that other parents in my position are afforded. Please give the courts the legal authority to consider our respective incomes in setting a fair support amount that can be legally ordered and enforced. Please allow my children to enjoy the same benefits that other children from divorced families have, whether from biological or psychological circumstances. Please give the court the discretion to really and truly serve the best interests of the children when making a decision about those children, whether the parents are biological or psychological. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Francis, did you have other testimony you want to have, or did you want to do Q&A?
Oh, no. If there's a Q&A, you know, I could respond to questions, but, you know, that's fine.
Right.
I think you folks have the gist of it.
Okay. Let's go back. Senator Cruz, did you want to follow up?
I'm just trying to understand the dynamics of all of this.
Sure. And,
okay, so you have a same-sex couple, and I think it doesn't matter whether it's a same-sex couple. Let's go to a traditional couple. Two people married have a kid.
Mm-hmm.
They get divorced.
Mm-hmm.
The custodial parent has somebody else living in the home. Okay, let's say it's a period of time.
Mm-hmm.
They're basically assuming the roles of a parent, obviously,
okay.
But then they split, okay?
Right.
If that other person just wanted to walk away from the relationship and say, I don't want anything to do with you or your family, would this put them on the hook for something, or would they only be on the hook if they still wanted to be involved in the kid's life?
They would only be on the hook if they still wanted to be involved in the kid's life, because you have to petition the court for psychological parent status.
Okay. That, I just wanted to make sure that there wasn't...
Sure.
I always look for unintended consequences.
Absolutely.
Okay. Okay.
I think the clarification is when the petition is made, then the court is going to be authorized, if we amend this statute, to consider what, if any, financial obligation should be on that psychological parent.
Okay. Thank you.
Right. Yeah.
I guess sort of along that line, Mr. Chair, I was thinking, what happens if the roles were reversed and the person with the money was the both the biological parent and then the other? I mean, just pretend it was reversed. Would this more affluent parent be able to come after the other, you know, Tara, in this instance, to contribute to support when she's really not in a position to do so?
The mechanism for that would be the traditional support calculations that are already in place. So if someone is less well off, they're going to see that in the income calculations, and then it's going to go through the calculation, and then the court's going to come up with a fair and just resolution for equalizing those situations in the best interest of the children. So, you know, we're not exposing anyone else any more than what they're already exposed to at this point.
Thank you. I just didn't want it to back and, you know, bite the...
Sure. Okay. Absolutely.
It's good to put these things on the record. And at the same time, I assume that the court does, in fact, have the discretion in any of these situations to actually determine that whoever would be designated or would be designated as a psychological parent may not have a financial obligation if the court deemed it, or is it automatic?
No, absolutely. I mean, that whole series of discretion in terms of calculating support would still be in play, but it would apply equally now to both psychological as well as biological parents to accommodate the circumstances that we live in now.
Yeah.
Right. But this does, I mean, we've already got guidelines, and so this,
absolutely.
This is just inside of what already exists.
Exactly.
Okay.
All right. Any other questions or comments? Tara, I want to thank you very much for coming forward. I know this is not easy to come in front of a panel of people you don't know and basically put your story out there. But these are the situations that bring us to the awareness to us as to maybe modifications that need to be done. And without these type of real-life stories, it's very hard for people to understand and appreciate what this really means. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to us. Thank you.
So I have a panel of three, at least, that have signed up that wanted to test me on this. Kate Richardson, Mike Ritchie, and Ryan Carty. If you all three would please come forward. And while they're coming up, is there anyone else in the room who will want to give testimony today on Senate Bill 1561? And before y'all get started, I just want to say this is, you know, like homecoming week.
I knew I wasn't going to get away with this.
Wayne come in, and then his best half through his legislative days is now here.
You understand that's been about, it's getting on 20 years.
I know it.
Yeah, okay.
Don't remind me, Kate.
Oh, sorry about that.
So, Kate, are you going to lead off or someone, whoever, however y'all want to do it?
I can, yes. Okay. For the record, I'm Kate Cooper Richardson. I'm the director of the Oregon Child Support Program at the Department of Justice. And we're providing some written testimony here today to raise some of the technical concerns that we see in the bill. We recognize it was really very helpful to hear the testimony today to identify what the problem was that we're trying to fix here. And we recognize that issue, and but we will say that as this bill is written, as the broader policy concern policies at issue here, this reaches farther than the problem that Senator Steiner Hayward's constituent is trying to reach. I will say that there we do have. We do accommodate same-sex couples or same-sex parents of children already in our child support program. Of course, there is now marriage, and so we recognize the marital presumption there, but also through adoption. But I recognize that in this situation, there was not an adoption, and it predated the legalization of marriage. That said, we believe there are some ways to address the two-parent model that we already have. This bill seems to reach farther to psychological parents where that can enter into another, introduce more parties to the child support calculation, and that is not the model on which the child support guidelines are based. I'm going to turn over to Mike Ritchie, who's general counsel for our program, to point out some of those concerns.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, my name is Mike Ritchie. I work as the general counsel for the child support program. And it was great to understand the problem this bill is trying to solve. I think that problem may be solvable, but in the short run, it presents some fairly significant complications for the child support program because our guidelines are built entirely on a two-parent model. There is no provision in the guidelines for a non-parent to pay support, nor is there any provision in the guidelines for support to be calculated considering that there might be more than two people that are responsible to support a child. So, this bill would not prevent a pair of grandparents from caring for a child from an otherwise intact family and then later moving to have custody of that child, and then suddenly you've got three potential people with parental rights to a particular child. Changing the guidelines is complicated. It is very difficult. We are required to calculate support in accordance with the guidelines, but under both state and federal law, and it would take a serious endeavor to revise the guidelines at this point to accommodate this situation. That is not to say that we don't support what the bill is trying to accomplish, but it is beyond anything that we have ever designed the guidelines for. I mean, there is specific policy in ORS Chapter 416 that says that children are supposed to benefit from the resources of both parents, as though that family was intact, and the guidelines have been based on that policy. They can be based on a different policy, but that would be a lot of work with commensurate fiscal impact.
Mr. Chair, if I may add, in this situation, it was clear that it was talking about or looking at two parents, but because the obligation would go against the non-biological parent or a psychological parent, we don't have a mechanism to create that duty on that person. It could go the other direction. We do have caretaker folks who are caretaking for children, and we do then can pursue child support against the biological parent. It's the specter of raising additional parties that really create a complication here.
All right, before we take Ryan's testimony, let me just make sure, clear thing, so there's no angst. The intent was to take the public hearing and do the public hearing. We're not planning on moving the bill. I recognize when this issue came up that there were a lot of, let's say, other issues that were going to arise from this. So my understanding, and Ryan, I know you're going to be giving some testimony, but this will become an interim work, and I believe the state bar has offered, at least through their committee process. I know Susan's back there cherishing this opportunity, but I will take some testimony because I've heard that the bar was willing to look at this in some fashion, because this is something I think that we're going to need to be dealing with because of the magnitude of the impacts on the kids and just how society's changed. So we're not, this bill will not move at this point. We will be doing more work on it during the interim. Ryan?
Thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. My name is Ryan Carty. I'm an attorney in private practice here in Salem, Oregon, and my practice is limited to family law. I'm here today, though, in my capacity with the Oregon State Bar, where I have the pleasure of serving as legislative liaison for the family law section and chair of the legislative subcommittee for the family law section. So Senate Bill 1561, I agree with both Ms. Richardson and Mr. Ritchie that the bill as drafted addresses a whole host of cases that are distinct and separate from the facts you heard today. And I'm not insensitive to those facts. These are facts that I deal with on a sometimes daily, weekly, monthly basis in my own practice. And these are children who need assistance. And certainly, one of the difficult issues you folks are faced with, the legislature is faced with, the folks in the child support division, judges, practitioners, and parents are faced with, is caring for and supporting children. That's a big issue. But what we have to be careful about is in implementing new legislation, we have to be careful that we don't create more problems than we're trying to solve. And so the state bar's concern with the legislation is drafted, and so I'm pleased to hear that the bill as drafted won't be moving, but the concerns are twofold, and I've provided some testimony on OLIS. I provided a paper copy because I got it in kind of late, but the primary concern is in the modification standard, and the bill is drafted, so I'm going to start with subsection D. Subsection D impacts the modification standard and indicates that, the support issue aside, that in non-parent custody and parenting time cases, a party who wishes to get back in front of the court need not make a showing of a substantial change of circumstances. And that's important because there are two different criteria for how you get a case back in front of the court after an initial custody determination has been made. Keep in mind, when parents or a non-parent in this case goes before the court for an initial determination, the court looks at the best interests of the child in determining custody. There's no showing of anything other than what will best suit the child, parent A or parent B. But when you go back to modify, if you want to modify custody, you have to show, one of the parties has to show a substantial change of circumstances. And that is consistent whether you're dealing with a previously married couple, whether you're dealing with non-married parents or whether you're dealing with an ORS 109-119 case where you have a parent versus a non-parent, whether that's a grandparent, a cousin, aunt, uncle, step-parent, same-sex couple, any of those situations, but they're all held to the same standard of you have to show a substantial change of circumstances. And the Court of Appeals, who is chock full of folks who are a lot smarter than me, has said, and I provided this quote in my written materials, allowing parents to litigate custody without showing a change of circumstances could subject the child's custodian, and the court to endless relitigation of the issue. So that's an important piece to keep in, and so that bill would potentially create a whole host of cases that could be continuously relitigated without any bar. And that's not in the public's interest, and certainly, keep in mind, the focus is on the child here. The child needs stability. And when we're talking about custody, we're talking about where the child has a primary residence, where the child goes to school, the medical attention that child receives, and what religion that child participates in, if any. Those are four big issues that we shouldn't be bouncing back and forth. Children can bounce back and forth with maybe I spend Monday with mom this year, and next year I spend Monday with dad. But it's important to keep a child's school, home, medical care, and religion consistent. So that is one concern with the bill, that it changes the modification standard, and it changes it only in this small subset of cases. The second piece is in child support, and I'll agree with the testimony you've already heard and received, which is the child support system is based on the concept of two individuals. And I'll be a little bit broader in terms of how I define those. It's not based on two parents, it's based on two individuals. I'll challenge that statute doesn't provide for this, because ORS 109-119 provides that the court shall grant custody, guardianship, right of visitation, or other right. But one of the rights to a parent, or even a non-custodial parent, or a non-parent, a right is a right to support. So I'll challenge that this is not necessarily a problem facing all of Oregon, but it may be a problem in this one specific case with this specific interpretation of statute in this particular matter. I do know that as a practical matter in the practice of law, judges expect that, particularly in situations like these where you've got a significant amount of parenting time, not visitation, but parenting time, that non-parent is going to be providing at a minimum, basic necessities of the child. That means putting a roof over the head, providing for food, having clothes in the home, and that sort of thing. Now, that's different, keep in mind, that's different than a child support obligation. But the issue is that ORS 109-119 applies to a whole host of non-parents, non-biological parents. And so in the same vein where you have a grandparent who comes in and says, well, I've established either a parent-child relationship, it's not actually psychological parents, parent-child relationship. And a grandparent or non-biological parent comes in and says, I've established that, provide me custodial rights. You also have those same grandparents coming in and saying, well, I haven't established a parent-child relationship, but I've established what is called an ongoing personal relationship. So I shouldn't have custody. But judge, if you don't afford me an opportunity to see these children once a month or once every 2 or 3 months or twice a year, something like that, I will no longer have a relationship with these children, and that's bad for the children. And so the court can then provide a really minimal amount of parenting time for this important relationship in the child's life. So the problem then is, how do you, now we've got a third party, truly a third party, not just two parent-type figures, but we've got mom and dad who they have their normal custody, non-custody, they have their normal parenting time, but then you have this third party too. And how do we fit them into the equation? Does that third party have the same obligation of support? And do we, in the current guidelines, do we say, well, this third party only has 6 overnights per year, and this third party has a huge amount of income, and so based on having only 6 overnights per year and a huge amount of income, does that go into the child support calculation? And I understand the concept, and I agree. The bill as drafted provides a huge amount of discretion to the court. But the system as set up is not prepared for that amount of discretion. There's no guideline, there's no help, there's no assistance, and it's going to create a bigger problem than we're trying to solve. Is this a problem? Yes. Is this a crisis for this particular family that you heard from today, from Ms. Carlson? Absolutely. This is a tough deal and a tough case. But is the change proposed in this statute going to create additional problems in practice for courts and families on a daily basis? It will. So I'd ask the committee to consider that in how it deals with this bill and these concepts moving forward, and I appreciate the opportunity to present some information to you today. Thank you.
All right. First, Ryan, thank you very much for your presentation and also all of the work you've done previously and hopefully in the future in helping us do these type of issues. Let me ask if there's any questions or comments for this panel. All right. So, as I stated, we're not moving this bill. This was an opportunity to put to say something on the record. The bill itself, clearly, as we all know, may come out of LC in one form, but before it actually goes through the to the floors and process, usually it has some type of modifications. I would not expect anything different than that to occur here. And I guess I am kind of looking for some direction because what I was the understanding I had from Senator Steiner Hayward was that the bar was willing to at least have this brought up in committee for some oversight and review. I do believe it's important enough for us to actually have some work done because this is not going to be the first and only time we have this type of presentation. And so I think it's now's the time during the interim. And if we can put something together for 2017, great. If not, then we'll see where we're going. But I really hope that we can at least have some type of venture in this area to see what, if anything, we can do or should do with all the dynamics, because it is very hydraulic as to the various variables.
Good point. I would agree, Mr. Chair, that I think Kate's about ready to say something, isn't she?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I was going to agree and also let you know that, of course, this issue has only become more to the forefront over the last year or so, not just for our child support program, but across the nation. And there are many efforts in which we are involved to address some of the issues that are raised here. This issue predates that, but it's a very real issue, and we believe there are ways that it can be addressed, and of course, this is something we are committed to doing because, as Mr. Carty testified, that's our job, is to make sure those children are getting the support they need.
Mm-hmm. All right.
I just wanted her to agree.
So. I'm glad you did. All right, so that concludes the testimony we're going to be taking today on Senate Bill 1561. So I'm going to go ahead and close that public hearing. And I believe that takes care of the work that we have for today, and we're on for
8:30.
You're still on.
Yeah,
I was going to say, I know there's an 8 coming. So, yeah, here we go. Tomorrow you get an extra 30 minutes like you did today, so it's 8:30. But just plan ahead Friday, even though it's Friday. We'll be meeting at 8 because we will have a full time need for that full time. With that, we're adjourned.